All right, so I picked a purposely vague title so I could discuss hopefully two projects. Most of the time I'll spend on using the Sinu-Zeldovich effect and X-ray data to determine distances to galaxy clusters. And then if I have time at the end, I'll come back to an X-ray only scaling relation project to also get at distances to galaxy clusters. Okay, so this is work, I keep forgetting to update this transparency, but this is work from a large number of people. In particular, John Carlstrom and Marshall Joy began this project a decade ago now. And I'm still at Chicago here, but I'm at Berkeley now, and Gil's actually at the IIS. People have moved around, but there's just a lot of people. And in particular, I'd like to thank the staff at both observatories we go to, the Owens Valley Radio Observatory and the Berkeley, Illinois Mellon Association Array. Without all their support and help for this decade of work, it certainly would not have been possible. Okay, so what the Sunyaev-Zeldovich what? Right. So let's talk about the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect first. Galaxy clusters are large, massive objects with hot gas trapped in their potential well. If a CMB photon passes through the cluster, it has a roughly 1% chance of interacting with the hot electrons. The CMB photon is cool, the electrons are hot, and they preferentially boost the CMB photon's energy and distort the CMB spectrum. As I show here, here is intensity versus frequency or wavelength, if you prefer, and in red is the 2.7 degree black body, which we know and love. So, blue is the distorted SC spectrum for an unrealistically massive galaxy cluster, so I could illustrate the effect. Well, you know, Sunyaev-Zeldovich did it first, so I thought it was okay. Notice that 1.4 millimeters, or roughly 218 gigahertz, the two curves cross, and you get the same signal from both the CMB and SC. For frequencies greater than 218 gigahertz, you receive more signal than you expect. You'd measure an SC increment. And for frequencies below 218 gigahertz, less signal, you'd measure a negative signal, SC decrement. We observe down here at 30 gigahertz, so we're going to observe a negative SC signal. All right, so now it's really a very small differential signal, unlike what I plotted. So this time I'll show a similar thing, but in different units for a realistic galaxy cluster. The observable delta T, so brightness temperature, because I'll be talking about our radio observations. So here is just Rayleigh Jeans temperature in microkelvin now. You can see it's a few hundreds versus frequency. And in blue, again, is the same SC effect I showed on the last plot, known as the thermal SC effect. There's another effect from just the peculiar velocity of the galaxy cluster moves if it moves along line of sight, or there's a component along line of sight. Relative to the CMB, this produces a Doppler shift, and it changes the effective temperature. This is shown for a pretty large peculiar velocity of 1,000 kilometers per second. It can be both positive or negative, depending on which way the cluster is going. All right. Well, so this more realistic units here. And again, we observe down at 3 gigahertz a negative signal. And really, the kinetic is just a small perturbation for us. It's not really a big deal. We're not going to worry about that. They do have different spectral signatures, and you could hope to disentangle the two with spectral SC measurements and actually determine the peculiar velocity. All right. Well, here is the state-of-the-art SC spectrum for the galaxy cluster of L2163. Just back to delta intensity here versus frequency. Down here is our 30 gigahertz point, and it's just the units. I mean, it really does have error bars. It's just, you know, it's close to zero in these units, so the error bars look tiny. The triangles are SUSY millimeter measurements, and the circle here is a Diabolo measurement. Blue here is the best fit kinetic SC, red is the best fit thermal, and black is the combined best fit curve. So, I mean, there are only a few points, and that's really just because SC is actually pretty tough to measure, especially for a wide range of frequencies. But this is the current best spectrum. And what's amazing to me is that these are different wavelength regimes, totally different observing strategies, and they suffer from potentially different systematics. But this one model, which is actually originally from the millimeter, just agrees very well across all these wavelengths.
How many parameters?
It's, well, there's the peculiar velocity and the Compton Y parameter, basically. Two. They're large, right. So, I mean, the uncertainties are large. So the peculiar velocity is something like 500 plus or minus, you know, 800 for this particular cluster. The constraints are just not good. Peculiar velocity is tough.
What do you measure an absolute spectral in this beam?
Excuse me?
What do you measure an absolute spectral in this beam or whatever? Or how is that? How is it going to get a point? How do you know that you're measuring?
These are all the central, essentially the central decrements.
So these are temperature fluctuations. There's a fluctuation, right?
Of course.
And then you map them onto this one. But they measure the angular scale, or how do you?
This is just the central. You know, you do a model fit to the cluster, and you determine the central. What do you expect the central decrement to be?
Or increment. So you only measure visibilities that are differences of center versus pixel next to the center, for example.
All right, we'll get to that later. I haven't gotten to that point yet.
Yeah, so there are more differences in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you model them together.
Yeah, this is all modeled to determine what we expect the central point of the cluster would be. It's all the same model.
But if the model
beta model.
The question is,
right. Okay, sure. That's true. So there is the cluster model underneath, which is. Well, I'll come to it later, but it has a normalization, of course. Well, it's two normalizations, because we use the X-ray data to constrain the cluster shape parameters, octahedral and beta. That would be five parameters, I guess. And like five data points, how convenient. I just noticed that, you know, I didn't notice that before. All right, well, why do you even want to bother with SC? Well, there's one particular feature of the SC, which deserves on transparency, mainly that delta T over T is independent of redshift. So this makes the SC a potentially powerful probe of cosmology in the distant universe. So let's try to put that to use. What could you use it for? Just a few applications of SC. Distances, when you combine it with X-ray, which spend most of my time talking about today, determine the Hubble constant and potentially the cosmology of the universe. And this method is independent of the extragalactic distance scale. It's a one-step distance. Well, you can determine masses. I mean, you're essentially, the SC is just the integrated pressure. If you integrate over the solid angle, you have the gas mass right there. You're measuring the mass of the cluster. With the gas fraction, you can determine omega matter simply by assuming clusters are typical of the universal parameters. So the gas fraction roughly corresponds to the baryon fraction of the universe, which is just omega baryon over omega matter.
That's assuming that you're measuring just the hot gas.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So, we can measure gas mass almost directly. We have to assume something, essentially, usually hydrostatic equilibrium to determine the gas fraction. And then omega baryon comes from, well, when we started this, it came from deuterium to hydrogen measurements combined with Big Bang nucleosynthesis calculations, and then you can get omega matter out. Well, we discussed peculiar velocities a little, but they're tough slogging right now, and the constraints aren't very good. A couple ways to get at electron temperature. If you assume clusters have a constant gas fraction, you could use that to get an estimate of the temperature from SC only. Or you could try to capitalize on the very small relativistic corrections, which are temperature dependent, if you had a really good SC spectrum and hope to get a temperature out. But that's pretty speculative at this point. What we really like to do is inventory the distant universe. Just find all the clusters in the different universe by doing an SC survey. You can determine the geometry of the universe, possibly even the equation of state of the dark energy, place constraints on structure formation models, do all sorts of things if we had a large sample of galaxy clusters. Of course, along the way, to get all these cosmological parameters out, we're going to learn all about galaxy clusters, which are interesting in their own right. Okay, so back to SC and measuring the SC effect So it's a very small differential signal. And a solution to this, to measuring this, is to use a millimeter array at centimeter wavelengths. Our receivers are based on low noise HAMP amplifiers with receiver temperatures 11 to 20 K or so. Pick a good compromise frequency or wavelength for observing the SC. Low frequencies suffer from point source emission, high frequencies dust, and we're going to use two millimeter observatories, so we already have dish sizes fixed. We can obtain fairly large fields of view with them at centimeter wavelengths. Maybe that's not large to you, but for an interferometer, 4 and 7 arc minutes is pretty large field of view. We place telescopes in a very close compact configuration to get an effective, very large effective resolution of 1 to 2 arc minutes, fairly well matched to cluster scales. So arrays are typically built for really high resolution measurements, and they place telescopes far apart. So we use it exactly for what they were not built for and put them as close together as possible. I'll show you an image of that. You can almost jump from one to the other. It's kind of scary watching them twirl around and almost collide. And last but not least is we observe in non-ideal millimeter weather, namely the summer, where the water vapor in the atmosphere makes millimeter measurements really tough. They often just shut down for maintenance, and we can get a lot of observing time in the summer, which is key. Why an interferometer? Well, you only measure correlated signal, and that makes them fairly stable, and it gives you low systematics. We can produce a two-dimensional SC image from that. We measure point sources simultaneously. Of course, everyone measures point sources simultaneously, right? But the spatial filtering of the interferometer allows one to disentangle the large-scale negative cluster emission from the small-scale positive point sources. And I'll show an example of that in image space. Interferometer also provides a very well-defined filter, which will become important when I discuss modeling, actually getting the parameters out so we can determine the distances. All right, just a brief picture tour of the observatories. This is the Berkeley, Illinois, and Maryland Association Array up in Hat Creek, California. Consists of, well, we use 9 6.1 meter dishes. They actually have 10, but one's an old style one. We can't put our own receivers in it. This particular configuration is all 9 are really close packed together for a CMB anisotropy experiment. When we observe clusters, we keep a couple clusters out at longer baselines so we can actually disentangle the point source emission from the cluster emission. If you squint, you might be able to make out Mount Lassen there. It's a pretty nice place to wake up in the morning. My lungs took a while to get used to it because the air was so clean, you know, it was kind of a shock. But it's really nice. And if you looked on the other side, there's this really great ridge if you like to bike or run or whatever. And if you get up high enough, a lot of people go parasailing and hang gliding off of it. It's really fun. All right. Well, we also go to the Owens Valley Radio Observatory in Big Pine, California, which is just outside of Bishop, a good popular spot for people skiing in that area. This consists of 6 10.4 meter dishes. I don't know. It's very scenic in either spot. This is just different. It's beautiful. It's deserty, but it's beautiful. Sierra Nevada is in the background. Clean air there, too. All right. So that's a visual tour of how we observe it. This is what we actually measure. This is a deconvolved SC image with the right ascension and declination on the axes, roughly 8 arc minutes or so on the side. This is for galaxy cluster CL0016 at a redshift of a half, which I'll use as kind of the sample, the test cluster throughout my talk. You'll either come to love it or hate it, I guess, by the end. So remember, this is a delta T measurement, so the zero level outside the cluster corresponds to the 2.7 degree black body, and that these are just small anisotropies on that fairly flat field. Negative signal shown with positive contours. The RMS of the map is roughly 45 microkelvin, and these are multiples of twice sigma. So you can just, 2, 4, 6, 8, 14 or so sigma peak signal to noise in the center. It's a very multi-high signal to noise SC image. The lower left-hand corner is the synthesized beam, so the effective resolution for this particular deconvolution of the data, and we did stress this short baseline, so the large angular scales before deconvolving this image to really bring out the cluster.
This is the beam array?
This particular one is for Abima. Yeah, yeah.
Is that a full width?
Or is that... That is the full width. I mean, you can taper it differently. And, yeah. All right. Well, one cluster, you'll be hard pressed to get a whole lot of the Hubble constant out for one. It'd be tough. But we have a sample. It's roughly 45 clusters now, I think. So we have a statistically significant sample of galaxy clusters with which we can do interesting things. So this is a panel selection of 12, ordered actually by redshift with their names on them. But if I didn't have their names and redshift on them, you'd be hard-pressed to tell the nearby from the distant ones, just kind of illustrating the redshift independence of the SC effect. It's very different for the X-rays. All right, so the first step in our spatial filtering tour here. This is the same BIMA contours I showed earlier, this time superimposed on an X-ray image, the WebSat PSPC in this case. They line up nicely, that's good. It's the same cluster gas emitting in both wavelengths. And the SE appears more extended than the X-ray, as expected, since SE varies as density, while the X-ray varies as density squared. It should be peakier. All right, what I want you to do is keep this imaging your mind just briefly. I'm going to show the same X-ray image on the same scale, but this time with contours from OVRO overlaid. And the dishes are larger. I got to work on the speed and changing those, huh? But you notice it doesn't fill up the whole slide anymore. We just measure a totally different range of scales. It's just the dishes are larger. We can't place them as close together. We can't measure as large angular scales. However, if you do a model fit, if you try to fit these clusters, or this cluster, to determine what that central decrement should be, they agree very well. Roughly 40. Yeah, yeah. This is why it's important to get all that observing time in the summer, because you can get 3 months. If you get 3 months of observing time, you can actually build up a sample of clusters.
So each of those
1 gigahertz higher. At OVRO, there's 2 gigahertz, and at BIMA, there's 0.8. All at 1 centimeter.
You pre-selected X-ray smooth clusters?
No. You'll see an example of that a little bit later. When it first started out, this project, there weren't all that many X-ray catalogs, so it was kind of every known X-ray cluster we looked at. Some are a mess, some are nice. All right. I don't know. I mean, I know our system temperatures, but that's...
What's your system temperature?
At zenith, it's roughly 40, 45 Kelvin.
Ground pickup?
That's scaled to about the atmosphere. That's the whole deal. With a large range, depending on weather. When it rains, it's bad.
40
is 35 is like roughly our best at zenith. So now we're going to go through actually trying to find and remove point sources from a data set, continuing with our spatial filtering. So I'll again show a series of images on the same scale. So it's roughly 20 arc minutes on the side. And the full width half max will be in the lower left-hand corner every time of the synthesized beam, so our effective resolution. The units on top will be, the color scale is in Jansky's per beam. Standard interferometer units. Okay, so this is natural, I call natural, is just all the data. Every baseline we have, just take the Fourier transform and look at the image. I never know what other people see. I mean, I stare at these a lot, but I see extended negative emission in the center. I mean, the effective resolution is small. This is definitely larger than that. So it looks like there's a cluster there. And there's a hint of something right around here, positive emission. All right. I also want to point out, notice this kind of large-scale symmetric pattern, which I'll come to later, this kind of six-lobed thing, which will appear later. Excuse me?
What is the higher frequency?
the higher frequency ripple pattern. Oh, it's just we. This is our resolution, right? Yeah, that's the. That's just our effective resolution. I could smooth it. Well, let's go through the images, and then you can ask again. I think it'll clear it up. Yeah. Now we're just going to look at the high resolution data. We're essentially cutting out the cluster because that's all large scale. So let's look at the long baselines. And we notice this fairly wimpy point source pop up. If we want to remove that, we can just clean it out and go back to our all of our baselines again. And now this little blip down there is gone. You can really see the symmetric, this six-lobe symmetric pattern. We know cluster scales are pretty large, so we're going to stress those large angular scales. And the cluster just really pops out now. And now you really see this pattern here, which is the synthesized beam. That's all the our effective resolution. This is the full width half max, but it's got all this structure in it. It's not as simple. It's not just a simple Gaussian. So that's what's really popping out. And so with that small scale stuff, it's kind of popping out all over.
Why is it correlated on such large scales?
This pattern, right? Popping out. So what happened was the cluster signal was so strong, even if you looked at all the baselines mixed in, it was picking out the cluster because it was just such high signal to noise. That's what I was trying to get to. All right. So now we have our cluster. Yeah?
Why is the earlier box, the white dot, really the resolution kind of symmetric?
It was just the way the telescopes were placed in the array. I mean, it just so happens that we never get good north-south and east-west coverage on long baselines because we just don't have enough telescopes to invest for point source coverage. We want to keep good SC signal. So it just so happens that this particular configuration is that all the telescopes that were closely compact were fairly symmetric. It's the same data, but different baselines. I'm stressing the very short baselines. All the telescopes that were close together were fairly well, you know, there's equal numbers in north-south and east-west baselines. Whereas for the long baseline data, you know, we had one guy way out on the north baseline, or, you know, just a little far out in the north baseline, but one guy way far out in the east baseline, something like that. It's the same, well, it's the same data set, but we're stressing different parts of the data, yeah.
When the when does that come?
That's the synthesized beam. That's the synthesis. This is all the, this you're, yeah, you're just seeing the point spread function.
What's the effective number of beams that we have here that you take now?
Well, when you deconvolve the cluster for BIMA, this is BIMA, you get 9-ish for this resolution.
9
effective full of half maxes to fill up the cluster. No, 3 by 3.
3 by 3.
Yeah. 9 pixels, right? Roughly. Well, in this super tapered map, yeah. Yeah. All right, well, this is the same deconvolved. You deconvolve the image now to produce a cluster image. And now, I don't know, you can fit maybe 12, but roughly, you know, a dozen or less synthesized beams in this cluster image. This is the same image I showed before, just on this expanded scale now.
Yeah, okay. I guess I understand. I can see you get 9 in the cluster itself, but in terms of the effective mapping of the whole region.
Oh, our effective field of view is roughly six arc minutes.
6 arc minutes.
Okay. 6 or 7 arc minutes. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. Yeah. Yeah. And a lot for the high resolution, right? All right. Well, that was a really strong SC cluster and a pretty wimpy point source. So it was kind of maybe a contrived example. So let's just run through quickly one more. This is RxJ1347. It has roughly 11 Milojansky point source on center. And we skipped this cluster in our first early days of observing. Actually, it was before my time. But in the early days of observing, this was skipped because this point source was just too large and we thought hopeless. So again, it's a series of panels on the same scale, except for now the units are millijanskis per beam instead of janskis per beam. This is actually the natural image. And all you see is a point source. It's just a boomer on center. So you could see why we might, if we didn't have confidence in our system, we might not want to try this guy. It's tough. But if you go through the same game, you look at the high resolution data, remove the point source, and go back to your natural, so all the data, again, you see negative extended emission in the center, apply a taper, we do the same song and dance, and then the effective resolution. I mean, deconvolve the image for this galaxy cluster here. So slightly more, slightly prettier images. This is just the same contours over there superimposed on an X-ray image. And what I really want to mention briefly is this figure. So we always really stress the large angular scales to really bring out the high single stars of the cluster, but we do measure a range of spatial scales. So this is, I did apply a taper, but I included some of the longer baseline data. So you can see there is some structure in the SE, although now these contours, instead of being 2 sigma, which I had shown before, these are now just multiples of sigma. So we lose some sensitivity, but we do have information on cluster structure, albeit weak. Okay. Now we're all spatial filtering experts. Now let's actually determine distances and eventually the Hubble constants. This is just the back of the envelope calculation, which is remarkably true to life of the actual calculation. So the SE signal is just the pressure integrated along the line of sight. If you look at the line of sight through the center of the galaxy cluster, it's going to go something like the central decrement, which is just the pressure times the length of the cluster along the line of sight. Similarly, for X-ray, it has a different, it goes as density squared and this X-ray cooling function. So if you look at the line of sight through the center of the cluster, it has this dependence. We're going to take advantage of the different dependence on density and eliminate density in favor of this line of sight length of the cluster, which has this particular dependence on the parameters. In particular, it depends on the central decrement squared and the X-ray temperature squared. All right, well, we need to know something about the geometry of the cluster so we can relate this physical size of the cluster to its angular size. So if you pick a spherical model, then you're home free, right? It's pretty simple, and you can just pop out a distance. Well, for a galaxy cluster, if you have its redshift and you pick your favorite geometry in the universe, you can turn this into a Hubble constant just from the theoretical angular diameter distance relation. I'll just stress that this is totally independent of the extragalactic distance ladder. It's just a one-step distance. Okay. Those are all the parameters we need. Now we have to extract them from the data. So come back to Whaley's point here. And we fit the data with the spherical isothermal beta model, which in addition to a normalization and has a characteristic scale, the core radius, and a power law index beta. And we're just going to perform a maximum likelihood joint fit to the SC and X-ray data, try to get the best constraints from this hot gas that we can by using both data sets. So the philosophy behind the analysis was try to keep the data in a reduced but fairly raw state and run the model through the observations to compare directly with the data. So in particular, for the SC data, we fit the data directly in the Fourier plane. We generate our model in the image plane, and then we Fourier transform it and compare directly with our visibilities in the Fourier plane. Compute the likelihood assuming Gaussian statistics. For X-ray, we use this standard reduction software to reduce the data, model the cluster as a beta model, and then a potential cosmic background. We mask out point sources and compute the likelihood assuming Poisson statistics. So the gory details are here if you are so inclined. The likelihoods from the two data sets, the data sets are independent, so the likelihoods can just be multiplied together for the joint likelihood. All right. So we crank through this, and so far I've only showed the SE data in image form, and I'm just going to show one SE radio, UV radio profile, just to show bend-up visibilities. And here we have the real and imaginary parts with residuals and units of the standard deviation here. So the points, of course, are the data, and the model is the green sampled the same way as the data. All right. Well, all we can say is that the data seem to fit, the model seemed to fit the data well. It's a good fit. Well, there's all sorts of interesting things about why we should or shouldn't expect an imaginary component, but I think I'll spare you so I can get on to a little X-ray size temperature stuff at the end, I hope. And just an X-ray profile, just a surface brightness versus radius, again, the residuals units, standard deviation. Just again, for all 18 clusters in the sample, this isothermal beta model, it's a simple model, but it fits the data pretty well. If you do simple chi-squared fit to the profiles, you get reasonable reduced chi-squares. All right. There is a known degeneracy between the shape parameters of the beta model, the core radius here in angular units, beta here, and I show the confidence regions, the 1, 2, and 3 sigma joint confidence for those two parameters. The best fit is the X in the center. All right, superimposed on these confidence regions are contours of angular diameter distance in units of megaparsecs here. And you can see they line pretty well with the degeneracy in the parameters, and this minimizes the effects of this. I mean, people used to worry about this a lot. I mean, it's not a real big deal. And it's, if you think about the model a little, it's not. It's what you expect. All right. Well, that was our favorite 0016, but this is a similar thing, but just for another cluster. And just, it's not a unique feature of a particular cluster. It's just that we're fairly well matched. It's our observing strategy. We're fairly well matched to cluster scales, and it's just things work. Wow. The degeneracy is not a big issue. I do like to point out that we are measuring distances to clusters that are thousands of megaparsecs away, which is an appreciable fraction, you know, of the distance to the edge of the Hubble volume, which is pretty, I don't know, it's fun. I think it's a lot of fun. All right, well, before the results, the bugaboo page. I won't go through all of these. But the big ones for statistical uncertainties are the X-ray temperature. It comes in squared. It's roughly 20%. That's often the largest uncertainty. And the parameter filling, fitting, which that 15% is roughly the uncertainty from all the shape parameters and normalizations for both XC and X-ray, although the SC normalization dominates this uncertainty. You'll see in a minute that systematics totally dominate the uncertainties. So, well, we have to start worrying about these now. The calibrations both come in. There is work being done to try to improve the SE calibration, and hopefully Chandra and XMM will greatly improve the unknown ROSAT calibration. I mean, it was, depending on who you ask, we get a different answer, but it's 10 or 15% uncertainty. Asphericity, kinetic, and actually also primary CMB. If you average over a large sample, you expect them to be uncorrelated, and they'd average out. So asphericity is roughly 20% from one cluster, beaten down by our root n is roughly 5%.
Does that include like oblates
along the cycles,
or is it just
non-sphere? Like oblate, prolate type. I mean, well, so we spent a lot of time, especially for LoRa's gas mass fractions, worrying about this cluster ellipticity, but you introduce more parameters than you can constrain. And it, yeah. So the idea would be in the end is to just get a really large sample and hope, yeah, that clusters really are randomly oriented, and then you'd be okay. There was a Sulkanen did a triaxial beta model study, and with a spherical model, you can reproduce the true Hubble cluster. It's exactly what you'd expect. All right, well, isothermality. Well, isothermality, it's roughly 10% for clusters, both cooling flow and regular. The X-ray, the band, the PSPC band, or the ROSAT band is just not very sensitive to temperature changes. And the SC, we don't measure really large spatial scales, so that the temperature profile is fairly gradual. We're just not sensitive to it because we don't measure the very large angular scales. So it's not expected to be too big, but you can just go out and measure these now. Right, Chandra and XMM are bringing these home now, so we can easily just include that in our models if we have a better data set. I mean, these data just didn't warrant this treatment. For the radio, undetected point sources in the field, we only measure so deep, and there could be point sources that are there that we just below our detection threshold. And I spent a whole lot of time worrying about this and keep refining our estimate of this. And it always comes out to be 12%, roughly 12%. No matter what, how sophisticated I try to make it, the same dumb answer I originally got keeps coming through. Because we have a complicated, it would be skewed because we do have, the synthesized beam is both positive and negative, so depending on where it would be, you can actually get the effect go either way. But it is skewed one way.
Why is clumping so large?
Well, I'm just getting to that. So we could, we in fact have VLA data, I just haven't finished going through it to actually get a better handle on this. Clumping, we just don't know much about the structure of cluster small scale emission. I mean, it just overestimates the X-ray emission, and so you just overestimate the Hubble constant. This 20% came from simulations where there is a hint that it's roughly at the 20% level. Clumping could affect stuff at 20% level. We really don't know much about this. Hopefully Chandra will tell us something with its better resolution about the smaller scale structure in the cluster. This is a big unknown here. I mean, I would claim that temperature profiles we can measure. We can start measuring these now with current X-ray observatories, and this we can get a handle on with current radio observatories. The clumping remains to be seen.
How do you distinguish clumping from these other? Just in terms of how you're categorizing, how is clumping different from asphericity, clumping and density?
Yeah. I mean, it was just a handle from the simulation to get a handle on it. Okay, so we crank through our 18 galaxy clusters, and this is what we find. Oh, that's too high. So angular diameter distance in megaparsecs versus redshift. Blue are our 18 galaxy clusters with 68% statistical uncertainties only shown. And obviously, your eye's drawn to a couple. And we also show the theoretical angular diameter distance relation for three cosmologies. They currently favor lambda cosmology, open omega matter 0.3 universe, and the flat omega matter 1 universe. So now we have a sample of galaxy clusters. We can do a simple chi-squared fit to these data for three different cosmologies to determine, and normalization is just the Hubble constant. I didn't say that well, but you know what I mean, right?
Those errors include all the systematic errors.
Statistical only.
Yes.
Yeah. So when we do that, our Hubble constant for the lambda universe is 60 plus or minus 4, roughly plus or minus 15 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And there is a cosmology dependence because we do have higher redshift clusters, 56 and 53 for the open and flat model considered. All right, well, like I said before, this is statistical and systematic uncertainties at 68% confidence. We're now dominated by systematic uncertainty. Well, and I showed that daunting list. But this is a step in the right direction because traditionally, distances to clusters were measured on a cluster-by-cluster basis, and then the statistical and systematic uncertainties are both roughly at the 25 or 30% level. They're roughly equal. So we're moving, one step at a time. Beating down the statistical, now we have to start worrying about the systematics.
Can you probably just say, is there either drawn to something
that one has to lay out? Yeah, okay, so two clusters. Here is MS-1137, and that's just high redshift guy at a redshift of 0.8. And the SC data is just as good as the low redshift guys, but the X-ray, in particular the X-ray temperature, it's just not well known. So the uncertainties are huge. It has no effect. Despite the fact I worked hard because it was, wimpy in X-ray, it has pretty much no effect on the fit, which is also a bummer because it means you're probably not going to be able to determine cosmology with this sample, right? This cluster, that's a Bell 370. This comes back to the question about how we chose our clusters. This is a XZ contours over an X-ray image again. And I don't know, what's the technical name for a cluster that looks like this? Train wreck, maybe? It's just not a spherical cluster. Not at all. I tried to look at every cluster we could that had good, you know, X-ray imaging, SE imaging, and a temperature. So I took everything. And it, again, this cluster, the uncertainties are huge for this guy. It's a pretty wimpy detection. Although, I mean, it's a mess of a cluster. It just has very little effect on the fit as well, in the end. I mean, in a large sample, you'd expect a few wonky clusters, I guess. We just got lucky, right, in our small sample. Okay. So here's my summary, my bias summary of DA's present and future. Here's angular diameter distance versus redshift again, and in blue are all of our points. They don't all fit on the scale because you saw those two, couple high points in there. They're just off scale. And in black is every other SE determined distance to a cluster. So you see we're kind of all working down at the redshift of a half or less region, but there's this whole big parameter space at higher redshift where the theoretical angular diameter distillation diverges, where we should be working so we can actually determine the cosmology of the universe. So if you do, I guess in our current sample, interesting point is that delta chi-square changes by roughly 0.3 between the lambda and flat omega matter 1 cosmology. We just don't have the power, and I tried my best, right, to determine cosmology with our sample, but it just don't have enough high redshift clusters. We don't have the leverage. But you get up towards 1, and these, you know, these curves pretty much flatten out, then you could really measure the geometry universe. Yeah, these are just 68% statistical. Well, the errors are still large. It's temperature and this the SE uncertainties that dominate the fit. Well, and some people weren't quite as laborious about worrying about their uncertainties as I tried to be, because it was my dissertation, right? All right, well, there's this whole big parameter space to work with, and, well, we have to find those clusters, though. And how do you find them? Well, you could really take advantage of their redshift independence of SC by doing an SC survey. But I think I'm going to, how am I doing on time, anyway? Okay. But instead of going into just a few details of that, basically the main point is that an SE survey essentially is a mass, has a mass limit, and it will observe all clusters above some mass limit at just about any redshift. You can actually find these high redshift clusters with an SE survey. So I'm going to switch gears instead and just briefly talk about another way to get a handle on distances and potentially determine the cosmology of the universe with galaxy clusters. This will be the isofocal size temperature relation. So galaxy clusters are fairly regular in their global properties. They exhibit tight correlations between global properties such as luminosity and temperature, and people, you know, they can be used in various ways. So I'm just going to talk about one particular relation. I define the isofocal size something like this. You just look at your cluster image. You take an isofoat in the cluster rest frame. This is all X-ray now. You plop it down. You just add up your angular area. You beat it into a circular form to get an isofocal radius, and take the square, you know, just by taking the square root, and you get some effective size of the cluster for that isofoat. If you plot it up against temperature, you find for the sample of 45 nearby clusters, you find a very tight correlation. Why is this interesting? Well, I'm just going to give you the tip of the iceberg on determining what that slope of the slope of the relation should be. We're going to start with a self-similar virialized cluster so that the radius in which the mean interior density is delta that of the critical goes something like temperature to a half. We can relate this, our delta, to our isofocal size using the isothermal beta model. Again, we're just going to run with that model. We're only really concerned about, we're going to pick isofoat that's far enough out where we're, you know, getting a large region of the cluster, but not too far out where we're in the noise. So, but it's far enough out where we're just considering regions distant so that the beta model reduces to something like this, and we just use that simple scaling relation to relate this Ri, isofocal size, to our delta, this being our isofoat. All right, so we did this whole song and dance, and when I put this together, I thought I had all the pieces, but I missed one important piece, which is relating the X-ray emission to the dark matter properties, which gets you from here to here. So I missed this really important piece on this transparency, and I'm sorry. But if you do that, and you keep track of all your T's, you find that Ri, in the end, Ri goes temperature to this alpha, where for the beta model, alpha is 3 beta over 6 beta minus 1. Okay, so beta model's been used extensively, and for typical nearby clusters, beta is roughly 2/3, so we expect the isofilter size to go as temperature to the 2/3. So we can compare this prediction with that data, and the local relation had, we just arbitrarily normalized it at 6 keV, it has a slope of 1 and not 2/3. So it's a little bit different. However, the nearby sample, there's a trend of gas fraction with temperature, so the slope is sensitive to anything with a trend with temperature. And in this case, the gas fraction, even though it's a slight difference in gas fraction from increasing gas fraction with temperature, it's enough to get from roughly 2/3 to close to 1. And the likely cause of this trend is the energy ejection during galaxy formation or preheating, which is a whole topic in and of itself. Okay, so it's not, well, maybe it's not ideal, but we think we understand what's going on. And
just say, well, I can understand energy injection gives you different temperatures, but what does that have to do with gas fraction?
Well, it just affects low mass clusters. Well, it could affect low mass clusters more than large mass clusters, just because there's just not, you know, there's less, I don't know, inertia, I guess. It's a whole topic in and of itself.
So the low mass clusters have a smaller gas fraction.
That's right.
So it's a little bit more of a gas fraction, smaller.
Yeah, that's a whole can of worms in itself, potentially. So, okay. We're reasonably consistent, or at least we think we know enough, to press onward and forward. So we think about the evolution of the ST relation. So we stick with our model. For the self-similar model, we just follow the evolution of the critical density, which is just, so we're just going to follow the evolution of the Hubble constant, which is just, I call the E evolution in units of the Hubble constant today. So we go through the same song and dance, and I didn't even bother trying to put all the steps this time because I was so disheartened I missed a few last time. But in the end, the isofilter size for a cluster of a given temperature at any redshift is related to that at redshift today with this evolution function to this power eta, which again for the beta model has this dependence. So we stuck our beta of 2/3 in, and we find that eta is 0, so we don't expect the SC size temperature relation to evolve, the normalization to evolve at all. Why do we care? Well, in principle, this makes this a way to actually measure distances to higher redshift clusters. Our measured value of the beta is actually the slope from the cluster modeling. That's the power law index for the beta model. We're going to go with, when we compare the distant and nearby ST relations, we're going to use that, the slope of 1 we found as our baseline. Too many slopes, I suppose. So here is the distant ST relation plotted up. And you notice some interesting things. Again, the isofilter size versus temperature here, and the red and orange are the 18, it's the same 18 clusters I used before. This time I did an X-ray only analysis. Are shown here, and you notice a lot more scatter in the relation. The green points are another, it's a different sample, intermediate redshift clusters, which I'll come back to in a little bit. Blue is the local relation. Well, the first thing is that the distant samples do show a correlation, but it appears that the slope, well, at least in my sample, is very different from the local. I haven't done anything yet. These red is for the red, green is for the green, and blue is the local.
What's the uncertainty on the slope there?
Aha, that's what I'm getting to. See, if I plotted the uncertainty on that slope, unfortunately, it would block out most of the data points just because it's not brilliantly known. Okay, so our asymptotic size, it's now closer to 2. It's really a steeper slope, but it's plus or minus a half or more in uncertainty. Okay, so we're roughly consistent with the nearby sample at 2 sigma.
That's 1 sigma
area. Oh yeah, it's all 1. Everything is 1 sigma. Okay, well, so there's this hint that the slope is actually steeper, but you can't really say much more than it's a suggestion, right? Okay, so what we'll do is we need more data, right? We need more data. We always need more data. We need a larger sample to actually test this model. It's all
at fixed temperature, where normally you say, you know, I can put energy in, and then you take it out again, and that's where you cancel it, you put in.
Shouldn't you block this as the radiant that would be much more radiant? How do you think?
Well, so this originally started as Joe and Gus Everard were looking at simulations, and they found this nice tight correlation, and the nearby sample has this nice correlation.
Right. Because at high redshift, right, we've got the average sample, we have the most powerful cluster, and lower density problem that can solve the cluster. So,
Well, we picked the isotope in the rest frame of the cluster, right? Not like at the detector. Yeah, at the detector. All right. So it's a little disheartening that we don't get exactly what we expect. But nevertheless, press onward and forward just because I'm so close, right? So close to finishing. The evolution is kind of, it's very tempting. So we don't expect the ST relation to evolve. We can determine distances with the simple pictures, essentially using that local relation as the standard rulers. And comparing with the distance, determine the distance, and determine the geometry of the universe, although you'll see our constraints in a minute. So you can turn this whole thing around, which might be the better use for this in the end, is that if we know the cosmology, which we're learning from other means, we can actually try to look at the evolution of cluster structure this way. All right, just a quick illustration of distances. You'll notice, it's the same, we're working in the same redshift area where we really want to be at high redshift to really determine distances. We don't actually use these distances. We actually compare the distant and local samples. It's slightly, it's slightly more consistent analysis, but this is the main idea. Same thing to get distances in the end. So we just compare the distant to nearby samples and try to determine cosmological constraints. But the first thing I'd like to point you to on this plot are the very large axis ranges. In particular, like 0 to 2 on omega matter and minus 2 to 2 on omega lambda. And, we're consistent with, there is a cosmology, but we just can't determine it very well. The uncertainties are just large. So you can try to build up your sample. Maybe you could really do this with a large sample. That's the next thing to figure out what I would really need to do this. I haven't gotten that far. You can combine this with that other near, our sample with that intermediate sample, but things don't change all that much. You just don't have enough power. We need to go to higher redshift. Okay, so I have two summaries for these two different projects with the same clusters. One. Worked more as we expected than the other. But nevertheless, clusters are fairly regular objects. They do exhibit tight correlations between some global properties of clusters. There is some evolution that clusters don't evolve to the, our standard self-similar model. Maybe our model's bad. That's another thing to work on. And currently, cosmological constraints are weak, but, it did rule out really crazy cosmologies with the current sample, and at least you could, in principle, determine cosmology with determine cosmology with a very large sample of clusters. So now, just because I don't want you to forget all that stuff where we spent most of our time on distances, I'm going to come back to that and summarize that at the very end here. So for the SE X-ray determined distances, the Hubble constant independent of the distance ladder is 60 plus or minus 4 plus or minus 15 kilometers per second per megaparsec. We're removing from having to worry about statistical and systematic uncertainties equally to now we really have to start worrying about these systematics. However, some of them are approachable with current X-ray and radio observatories, such as temperature profiles and point sources in the field that were below our detection threshold. So here's my separating the VA's past and present, past and future, or present and future, I should say. Here's where we work now. This is where we want to go, so we can actually determine the geometry of the universe, ready to do it, but we need to find these galaxy clusters, and SE survey is a great way to go. Thanks.